Okay, let me summarize what's going on with Palomar Quest survey, and I'll, at the end, I'll make some more general comments about this area of astronomy. There is, of course, abundant literature in transients. This is what I'll tell you about. There are two excellent virtual posters by Mahabal and Drake et al., and there was, of course, talk by Greg Aldring about particular usage of these data. Here is the camera. The first slide was, of course, the telescope. There's 112 CCDs. About 5% of those don't work at all. Another 5% are bad enough to be of questionable utility. But by and large, most of them do work. The A omega for this telescope and the detector is about 11 meters squared degrees squared, so it's reasonably respectable. The camera was built at Yale by Charlie Bolte's group on the cheap. That's the key word. You get what you pay for. So a lot of artifacts from these detectors, and they have to be taken out in the software. This is just a drawing of it to give you a physical size of it. And the data are taken in two modes, the traditional point and shoot, which is what solar system people use with appropriate cadences for their research. And you get 9.2 square degrees covered per exposure. And a drift scan mode, which then gives you strips that are 4.6 degrees wide in the sky with four filters. You notice the CCDs are lined up in these four fingers, which are tilted piezoelectrically to tangentially match curvature trails of stars on the sky. And the declination range is then given by the amount, how much distortion can you tolerate in residual smear, geometrical smearing. So it gets to be plus or minus 25 degrees. So dwell time is about 140 seconds divided by cosine delta per CCD in drift scan mode. And we cover about 500 square degrees per night. So just to clarify, there is Palomar Quest Consortium, where 40% of the time goes to Yale and Indiana. They built a camera. Most of this, almost all of it, is used in drift scan survey. 40% goes to JPL for search for near-Earth asteroids. And 20% to Caltech, which is, again, divided roughly equally between point and stare for Kuiper Belt and drift scan for Palomar Quest survey. The survey's collaboration, two major groups are Caltech and Yale. There are many others. A lot of people are involved. I want to point out Ashish Mahabal there. He is essentially my deputy PI at Caltech and project scientist. And Roy Williams, who is our main VO person. I'll talk more about that later. Charlie Bolte is co-PI at Yale, and David Rabinovitz is probably the principal person there. Okay, so just a few points to bring up. We get about 70 gigabytes per night worth of data. Over 12 terabytes are already in hand. We can now process data the next day. Sometimes do and sometimes don't. And we're going towards real-time processing by the middle of this year. We started getting some kind of data in summer of 2003 and encountered a lot of problems. I'll talk more about this. An important point about the survey is that we built NVL standards, connections, protocols in from the start. I think it's the first major survey completely designed and built up in the VL era. It has synoptic nature with baselines ranging from minutes. A star goes from one CCD finger to the other, to years, and then cross much to archives, goes to decades. And it's perhaps useful to think of it as a both science and technology precursor and testbed for bigger and better things to come. So here is the sky coverage. We're limited due to geometry to plus or minus 25 degrees. We have actually covered 15,500 square degrees to date, about 10,000 of that at least five times. And this is coverage map just a couple months old for one of the two filter sets that are used, which are shown here, minus the U band that I didn't care about. So data are taken roughly equal amounts of time in Sloan R, I, and two Zs, which are identical, or Johnson UBRI. These are limiting magnitudes in a single pass in good conditions. And we demonstrated if you add about six or eight of these, we reach depth of Sloan for point sources in redder bands. So we'll keep co-adding the data.
Is that the real fidelity logon, which you can see very little?
No. In a single pass, it's limited to depth, its depth, right? And so in good conditions, it's these magnitudes. But then if you want to do archival variability quadding stuff, then you can go deeper. So the data come from 48-inch down microwave length to San Diego Supercomputer Center, and then they're parsed out. They feed several independent data processing pipelines, each of which is optimized for its own science. It's like a physics experiment in the same sense that the same accelerator beam would feed many detectors. So the pipelines can be optimized for supernovae, for asteroids, for whatever you need. We have a lot of computers, let's not tell that. Plenty of computer hardware and to be fed and taken care of. The science drivers for the survey are a combination of many things. It's a very general survey. It can feed different kinds of science. From our viewpoint, high redshift universe by finding a lot more quasars, the redshift is greater than 4, up to 6.5 is one of them. Yale people would like to find many gravitational lenses. And a big and increasingly more important science driver is exploration of a time domain. Okay, so the raw data that come from these inexpensive CCDs are very, very dirty. And it took us a long time to understand all of the problems with it. So you have variable dark currents, bad combs, whatnot, and we, after a lot of pain, we learned how to clean data very well. Because all the interesting stuff that we want to do relies on finding some sort of outliers in some parameter space, either in color space for quasars or in time domain, something was is there now, wasn't there before, and you really want to clean the data well, not to be drawn by false positives. So let me illustrate this, a great mosaic made by Roy Williams of a pair of galaxies in just using RGB color in 16 different passes. And then after we clean this and add them up, it looks like this. And the depth of this is a little higher than Sloan, with 16 passes. So this is ultimately what all the survey data will look like. That's what we're working on, except that we'll be subtracting galaxies away. We decided they're just not worth the pain. It's better to subtract them out, consider them annoying foreground. What we're doing now is we're completely redoing data reduction pipelines at Caltech with this vastly improved cleaning. We'll be quadding images and using HyperAtlas technology, which is emerging VO standard, and many other improvements. Probably not very interesting. So far, we reprocessed over half of it, and then we're moving into the real-time detection pipeline where we'll be collaborating with solar system people. One interesting project we did as a public outreach is to make this large image for Griffith Observatory through a Virgo cluster that's now been installed in their new exhibit hall. It's 152 feet long by 20 feet high. It goes to Virgo cluster 15.2 by 2 degrees, and the data quality is what you've seen. And to do this, we did about 2 dozen passes through this region of Virgo cluster, and an average spot was covered 12 or 15 times. Sometimes they're bad CCDs. So this is an excellent test set to start looking at some time domain stuff. And baselines now range from a couple hours to a year and a half. I'll show you some examples from that. Well, here are some of the transients. This is, again, objects that don't look like artifacts. They're detected only once. They're found in archival search through our database. And some or many of them turn out to be asteroids. Here are some in the big picture, and often we can tell that they move. These we can tell that they move. They're faint, they come up, they go away. We have usually images both before and after. Here's some more. Different filters. And then Ashish started reducing neat data, which are taken to look for solar system objects, so variables in there we call orphan transients, as opposed to orphan afterglows. And yes, there are things that appear and go away. I'm sorry the projector is not showing the depth of the images, but it truly isn't anything in these other circles. And time baselines there are typically of the order of 20 minutes, so it's a different portion of parameter space. We see things that are always there, but vary by a substantial amount. where the stars are radiant. Asteroids are often very easy to spot. In color, false color images, they have this interesting stretch rainbow appearance because they cross different filters at different times, so they smear out. And by and large, most of them move enough for us to just eliminate them on the basis of apparent motion. The scary point is that even in direction of Virgo, which is high latitude, galactic latitude, and high ecliptic latitude, we have about 1 or 2 per square degree per pass, down to the limit of single pass. Vermin of the sky, a lot of flying rocks. And at this magnitude level, many of them are not cataloged yet. Here, some more. Sometimes it's blatantly obvious. In this case, here is the one that came, covered this star in the middle, made that star look brighter too, and then went away. So a lot of that will happen because there are a lot of stars in the sky. So we're now absolutely convinced that we have to do a joint analysis for moving and variable objects, that there is just no, it makes no sense to separate these two streams. Ashish has developed a simple GUI that will interfaces to asteroid databases that will let us find out if some of these things are known. We are going to be automating that, making it much more powerful. And here is a cute example that Roy and Matthew Graham have found, the pre-discovery images of new planet X, Xena, or Lila, whatever its name is going to be, a few weeks before Mark Brown actually found it. And had we had the real-time pipeline going on back then, we would have found it, right? Because it's there, doesn't move very much, but it wasn't there in the archival imagery, which down to this level is pretty much available over the entire sky. So we're certainly talking with Mike Brown about how we can combine these efforts to find really slow-moving ones, and there'll be more planets. Now, of course, there is a lot of junk. These are not very good devices. There's a lot of artifacts which are usually recognizable by image shape parameters, by the persistence in chip coordinates and things like that. And if you're willing to throw away a lot of data, you can make fast progress. If you want to extract all of the useful data, then you have to do some really good cleaning. So where are we going next with Palomar Quest? Is we're going to finish really buffer cleaning pipeline, start quadding images, get catalogs from them, and we want to build a data product, evolving data product, which I think should be useful community-wide, a fiducial sky for all kinds of variability and motion studies that would incorporate not just our own data, but existing survey, photographic, phone, two mass, all remapped into a standard image grid against which one can then compare single epoch observations and see if there's something new and different. And so some prototyping of this we expect will be done later this year, and real-time operations perhaps next year. So let me talk a little bit about VO Event Net project. Roy Williams should answer all questions about that. It is a prototype system to incorporate a large synoptic sky survey like this in virtual observatory environment. It's a partnership between Caltech, Fairtel, Josh, Raptor group, and possibly ESTAR group at UK. And for this particular system, Palomar Quest will be the principal event factory, although we listen to the others. And good progress has been made. Roy can probably talk more about this. And the idea is to not just assemble events, to publish them electronically, to gather new data, to evolve them until they're better understood, all done inside what's now emergent standard. So here's one of those impenetrable flowcharts. It's just upshot is data come up there, they'll be reduced in non-real time for their own purposes. Quick detection will be done in comparison to fiducial sky. Asteroids, non-asteroids eliminated. Then a lot of magic happens here, okay? Where things are obtained, you know, preliminary classification. What are they? Alerts are then issued to our friendly robotic telescopes, which may or may not provide more data feed back. Everything is posted on the web for the whole world to see all the time. Subscribers can get special messages, very much, you know, among GCN model. So the box in which a lot of magic happens is event classification engine. We're just beginning to scratch on this. This is the conceptual idea. You measure a whole bunch of stuff for any event. Magnitude is a function of time in one or more filters. Position of the sky, how fast it's moving, what are the image shape parameters, and so on. All of those contain useful information to tell you what could it be. Additional useful information you can obtain from a variety of existing archives in VO framework. If your transient has an infrared counterpart in Tumas, chances are much higher that it's a flaring M dwarf than if it wasn't one there. If it's a radio source, chances are much higher it's an OVV, BLAC, than something else, and so on. We also need to encode a great deal of expert information on things like colors. These are typical colors of asteroids, of CVs, of quasars, light curves, what's the maximum rate of brightness increase or decrease. And all of those form likelihood priors that this machine can then use and associate probabilities with. And its output is a set of probabilities, which say that for each one of the known kinds of things that we know go bang at night, there is such and such current probability that belongs to that class. And they can be all very low for something that's new and exciting. Now, that is the information that's broadcast. Consumers of this can then decide, is it interesting enough for them to spend time following it up? If this is classified with 90% likelihood to be supernova 1A, and that's what you want, then sure, go and do it. Then also, remember, there is a feedback loop here. As the new data come back, then that gets to be much improved, and better classifications get to be derived and put in events portfolio. This does have to involve collaboration with computer science people, and we had long-standing and very productive collaborations like that, and statisticians. And it's actually useful. Statistics not as a substitute for data, but as statistics as a means of exploring your data properly. Techniques like these have now been established in astronomy for other things, like star galaxy classification panoramic surveys. This is a well-established field that neural nets, decision trees, all kinds of other stuff, Kohonen maps are used and applied with a great deal of success to classify things, a star versus galaxy. The new challenge is to classify things in time domain as events on the basis of much more heterogeneous and diverse and more interesting information. So it's a very good problem. There are prototypes. Andrew Drake has made VO EventNet webpage where he feeds in GCNs, just repackages them into this virtual observatory format with links and all kinds of other good stuff. You should go and check it out. But equivalents of this can exist for other event factories, not just gamma ray burst missions, but Quest and others. Now, writing the software is really hard. Right? These are extremely demanding software systems. First of all, because you're generating a lot of data, you have a lot of glitches too, right? And because you're pushing things to the very frontier, things are not very stable, right? Recipes for disaster. And you want to be very complete, not to miss anything interesting, and yet not generate gazillion false alarms for every real one. That is a very hard balance to achieve. Moreover, you have to do this in real time. Time scales of minutes, because we want to catch up these things while they're hot, right? And so that, as Tom explained very well, requires fully robotic systems with no humans in the loop. And those robots have to be reliable, right? That's not an easy thing to do. So these automated, reliable, objective event classifications are an absolute necessity. If you have a survey whereby some data are taken last night, and then somebody who's an expert takes a look at them next day, they can say, oh yeah, that looks just like RSCanVen. But if you want to do this in the middle of the night, in a time scale of 1 minute, and to do it thousands of times, you have to have machine learning involved. There's just no going around it. This is the next step. Okay, so let me summarize. What have we learned so far from the data? First, we learned that there's a lot of different things out there that go bang in the night. And the same survey will generate a variety of different astrophysical phenomena and sources for many different experiments to follow. So far, many surveys have been designed as targeted to a particular kind of science, and a perfectly right thing to do. You want supernovae? You build survey for supernovae. Right? But you will catch everything else too. Right? Having a systematic exploration is not the same thing as hoping for serendipity. If we admit up front that we don't really understand the faint variable sky very well, then, you know, systematic exploration of this parameter space is reasonable. And one can have surveys which are general, LSST and PanSARs or QuEST, and have surveys which are directed to a particular thing. But everybody is going to get everything, right? Okay, useful number to remember, down to about 20th magnitude, if you take snapshots of the entire sky, you'll find about 1,000 transients defined as point spread function-like objects that weren't there before, down to, say, at least 2 or 3 magnitudes fainter than the threshold. And I believe, this is not counting asteroids, just outside solar system, a lot of those are known kinds of things that we know and love or hate, flaring dwarfs, cataclysmics, AGNs, and so on, and some could be something new and interesting. Probably the biggest lesson we learned so far is that we have to work with solar system people. That asteroids, even if, you know, there'll be some fraction of them which are moving very slow and not easy to throw out, will be probably the most significant contaminant in this game. So a joint reduction of the data is really necessary. Okay, so a few thoughts to end up with, right? Finding these things is just the beginning after all the pain. 99% of your science is in follow-up, which is usually spectroscopy, finding out what it is, how far it is, how hot it is, and all that. Some of it is multi-wavelength imagery. Spectroscopy is already, and I predict will be, much more of a bottleneck for everything. People can talk all they want about photometric redshifts, but the fact is, you will need real spectra in order to do most of the science. And I think that'll be a matter of all bottlenecks. So whoever has good spectroscopic facilities for follow-up will win. The multi-wavelength synthesis is essential, and gamma ray bursts are a beautiful example of how that worked, from gamma rays all the way down to radio. And that's for both interpreting what you got and for follow-up and science later. And virtual observatory environment is a natural environment to do multi-wavelength astrophysics. It's also a natural environment to do publishing in real time, bypassing grossly obsolete media like IO circulars. Finally, one point which is seldom really understood is that I think that nowadays most astronomical projects, anything that does a lot of data gathering, any survey, are largely software projects, where you end up paying at least 1/3 and maybe as much as 80% of your total money on software, one way or the other. And you can do this up front, or you can do it later by not recognizing the fact up front. And if you do it later, it's usually more expensive. So synoptic sky surveys can push the trend only further out. And nobody should underestimate the importance of this. These are software projects first and foremost. Telescope is just little 4 optics in the front of an instrument, which is just the front end to what's the real instrument, a great software machinery that actually ingests the bits and spits out interesting stuff at the end. And it behooves us to try to solve these problems together and not everybody reinventing their own wheel. So, okay, I think that's all I had to say. Thank you.
Event classification, you mentioned you can figure out probabilities of some of the AGN and kind of some variables. Are there any plans for any speculative knowable unknowns or whatever, based on some theorist model, adding in that kind of?
You could, obviously, it's an extendable framework. If you had a model of how light would vary, mm-hmm. what colors would it have, radio versus non-radio, et cetera, you could generate likelihood curves. And so here's a model for the event or a family of events, and I can catch it at a random time. And so depending on that, there is distribution of how much light variation I would see, what kind of color I would see, and things like that. Absolutely, you could have that. So the beauty of that approach is its modularity, right? It's extendable, but you don't have to actually have real survey people do it. Of course, they would like to, right? You could have an aggregator or a processor whose business is nothing but to ingest data streams from various surveys or experiments and have their own set of models and classification criteria and produce what they think is the best set of events of a given sort. It all works.
We learned yesterday that there's this, using exactly the same camera, the Quest camera, there's a group, Lawrence Berkeley Labs, that found 160 type 1 supernovae.
Those are just supernova, period.
Supernovae, sorry, okay. And so what is it about the approach that you're doing that's so much more difficult? They've identified a very key science objective using the same data stream, essentially, and been able to find 160 transient events, but with very specific criteria. Why is it so much harder? Is it so much harder to find generic variables?
No. First of all, I think it's
a lot of work.
Greg might it sound a heck of a lot easier than it really is.
That's right.
If you paid attention, he said from November 05 round we did this. I don't think that they reduced all of the rounds at the same degree of assurance because it's a really difficult thing to do. They do build on an existing set of software they had from previous stuff, and so do we in many cases. But yes, generally speaking, if you narrow down your scientific objectives, then you can ignore many sources of problems that you would have to deal otherwise.
And a simple example is if we see something just once in a triplet of images, we consider it no further. Whereas, George would be interested in something that would show up just once, potentially.
Well, another example to put up is Mike Brown, which has been spectacularly successful using the same camera in point-and-stare mode. What he does is he throws away a great deal of data. Anything that's at all suspicious, out, in terms of, you know, associated with chip defects and so on. Or perhaps being foolish by trying to salvage all the information that can be salvaged.
Micron uses a single filter, and I guess you two tend to do image subtraction with the same filter, right?
Yes. He doesn't care about photometry very much, right?
So George, this flow chart is really impressive. I'm trying to get a sense of, with current technology, how long does it take between an image being read out and this sort of probability distribution being...
The goal is to do it in a couple of minutes.
And what is sort of the time scale? And that's sort of roughly the time scale between... consecutive images as well?
Well,
it seems like it's something longer.
It's a continuous data stream, which has then been artificially chopped up in frames that are 2400 pixels long. And first we will probably deal with those, so there is that latency of just packaging pieces of drift scan. Then they move down very fast from the mountain in principle. This is not computing limited. This is expertise limited. Right now.
Yeah, so if the knowledge is somewhere in the software, then it's a few seconds.
Yeah. Computationally, this is an easy problem in terms of just front of computing. It's tedious to get it all working in a reliable and fully automated fashion. The real skill comes in generating these priors and then having proper inference engine that will combine and spit out these numbers.
I have two comments more than questions, but maybe they'll generate comments on comments and some discussion. We followed this very same approach you have on the overhead with Sloan repeated scans. And it works nicely down to a limit that gets formed by false positives. And we realize that the missing component in this diagram is to know what's around you. You need to also look at your neighborhood. It's not sufficient to look at a single detected source. For example, you may have diffraction spike from a star 15 arc minutes away.
Absolutely.
Huge galaxy. And
I couldn't agree more.
And in practice, it turned out that it's very computationally hard to do that, much harder than all these things, to actually keep track of your nebula. Then the other comment is, when you said that spectroscopy will be bottleneck for all synoptic surveys that are coming online, of course, you can always gain more information from spectroscopy, but one characteristic of PanSTARRS and LSST will be unprecedented photometric accuracy. They will be even more accurate than SMOD by at least about a factor of two. And actually, this factor of two in science terms means almost factor of 10, roughly speaking, because you start being able to separate stellar populations if you're interested in the Milky Way. You can separate families of asteroids if you're interested in those variants. You can actually do cosmology with PhotoZs, as was demonstrated, with inferior accuracy from SMOD compared to PanSTARRS and LSST. You can get baryon oscillations with PhotoZs.
Well, yes and no. You're entirely right. For things that are well understood, PhotoZs numbers and so on, PhotoZs will work fine. Normal stars, normal galaxies. Here, by definition, we're dealing with things that usually you don't know what they are. And they can have any damn spectral energy distribution they wish. And it could be at any redshift. So I think that PhotoZ approach almost by definition fails for exploration of the new.
Yeah, I agree that if you're talking about only the subset of all the science,
on the steady data, generic large N galactic structure and cosmology, you're right.
Do you think it is feasible to do automated spectral analysis? Because it's important that it can also be very time variable. For example, there's supernova classification. It may start out as a type 2, and then a few days later, it's more like a 1B.
Yeah, I think
when I do this all by hand, it's just a...
Yes, I don't know if anybody's done it for supernovae, but people have done that for stars. They use various versions of neural nets and such to do stellar spectra classification. And I'm sure it'd be just as feasible to do it from supernova spectrum libraries too.
So for your transient detection, do you use a catalog search or you find them from galaxy subtraction? Because these two approaches will give you different, difficulties and also you are probably knows some kind of different other kind of transients that if you do a catalog search, you probably will miss some supernovae in the galaxies. On the other hand, if you do a galaxy subtraction, you know, you will miss some of the variable stars, possibly, and things like that. So how do you really analyze
your
transients?
Even in image subtraction, you always end up making a catalog, right?
That's right.
Yeah. So you're always down on catalog level. Image subtraction techniques are especially useful when you're dealing with embedded sources like supernovae, part of a galaxy image, then that certainly helps. It poses additional technical requirements, being able to do cross-matching of PSFs and all stuff that can be very messy and involved.
And the fourth alarm.
So I suspect initially, at least, we will operate in catalog domain. Then as we gain confidence, we'll expand into the image domain. Supernova Factory is operating in image domain for their specific purpose, and obviously when Greg cracks the whip enough, they got to reduce fast enough to actually get spectra, so that works.
Okay. Two more questions. So I see the benefit of feeding back into the system so you produce a better and better catalog, but is there any plans for creating persistence so that you could say, on this day, our catalog looked like that, and so if you want to go back and ever sort of start working on the demographics, you have a better sort of handle on the statistics?
Yes. I expect that we'll be updating fiducial sky on kind of monthly basis, roughly speaking, and the exact format of manifestation and how many versions are checked and how and where. That's something TBD. We have to think carefully what science drivers justify expenditure of archiving how many past versions. In principle, we'll save all of the initial data that have been
properly scrubbed from artifacts, so one can always go and recreate. It's like a virtual data approach. You don't store data products, but you know, you regenerate at the max.
One more question? No. You have one?
No, I can wait till lunch.
Thank you, Gabe.